I was by myself, and I was driving down to Pittsburgh on a Sunday morning to preach, and I was having my stroke while I was driving and while I was preaching. And tonight, when Ray handed me this microphone, I thought about the fact that the last person that wore this microphone, who was a dentist, had a heart attack when he got through. I've already had a stroke. I don't need a heart attack. So it's good that we're not superstitious, right? Okay. Open. Right.
Paramedic standing by.
Okay. Good. Good. Not a bad idea. Okay. 1 Samuel chapter 1. 1 Samuel chapter 1. We're going to begin tonight on a new study. It's going to be a study in the book of 1 Samuel. It's not a study of the book of 1 Samuel, but a study in the book. 1 Samuel tells the story principally of three men. It's the story of Samuel, Saul, and David. Samuel, the prophet slash judge, Saul, the rejected king, and David, the shepherd king. But our focus is going to be principally upon Saul. Tonight, what I'd like to do is start off in chapter 1 of 1 Samuel with the goal of sort of setting the stage from a historical standpoint. So we have some groundwork. As I begin to take a look at Saul's life, I realize it's important to understand something about the times in which he lived and the things that happened just preceding his inauguration as the first king of Israel. So we're going to be taking a look tonight at chapter 1 of 1 Samuel. Samuel was the last of the judges and one of the first of the prophets. He wasn't actually technically the first prophet, although for all practical purposes he was. Abraham is actually called a prophet. So you can't legitimately say that Samuel was the first prophet. Abraham was a prophet. But basically he was the last of the prophets. He sort of bridged the gap from the judges to the prophets. And he was the one that had the privilege of inaugurating Israel's first king. Now, our story begins basically in the days that the judges ruled. That's when Samuel appears on the pages of Scripture. Now, what do we know about the days when the judges ruled? Well, they were some of the darkest days in the history of Israel. Very dark days. They were marked, now listen to this, they were marked by moral corruption, civil strife, fighting amongst themselves, religious apostasy, and individual lawlessness. The verse that comes to mind when we think about Judges, it's repeated, I think, four times in the closing chapters of Judges, is this verse: in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. That was the tenor of those days when the judges ruled. Everybody just did what they thought was right. There was no king. There was no absolutes. Think about that. And the parallels with our country today: moral corruption, civil strife, religious apostasy, individual lawlessness. Sounds like the United States to me. The days when the judge, there were dark days. I believe we're in perilous times. I really do. And every man did that which was right in his own eyes. That's the prevailing sentiment today. It's tolerance. You know, you do what you want to do, and I'll do what I want to do, and this person does what they want to do, and whatever you do, don't offend one another, and we'll all get along and live happily ever after, except it doesn't work. In reality, it doesn't work out that way. But that was what characterized the days when the judges ruled. So, in days like that, you ended up with a carnal people, a fleshly people. And a fleshly people are going to have a fleshly priesthood, and that's what we're going to see was the case. And a fleshly people with a fleshly priesthood are going to have a fleshly king, a carnal king. A carnal people with a carnal priesthood are going to end up with a carnal king. And that is exactly what we see. If David is known as a man after God's heart, then Saul would be known as a man after the flesh. Now, generally speaking, the ruler of a nation, the king or the president or whatever, is a product of the times in which he lives. And sadly, that was true of Saul. He was representative of the people. He was the ideal of the times. He possessed the qualities and the abilities, all the excellencies that were most admired by man in that day. Psalm 39 and verse 5 says this: every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Every man at his best state is altogether vanity. And Saul was the best that they could produce. They wanted a king. They wanted someone to go out before them and lead them in battle. They wanted to be like the other nations. And they got what they asked for. They got somebody that was the ideal man for those times. But they were very dark times. Now, before we distance ourselves from the people of that day, let's remember that there's a sense in which Israel is representative of the whole human family. What do we mean by that? Well, I think it would be true to say that Israel in that day was the best nation on earth. They were a chosen people. They had all sorts of advantages and privileges that other nations did not have. They were a favored people. And we have a picture of them in Isaiah chapter 5. And there Isaiah tells a story describing Israel in that day. And he says that God took the choicest vine and he planted it in a fruitful hill. He put it in fertile soil. He dug the rocks out. He put a hedge around it. He put a tower in it. He did everything he could possibly do for Israel. And then he stepped back and he waited to see if they would bring forth grapes. But instead, what did they do? They brought forth wild grapes. They had everything going for them, and all they brought forth was wild grapes. You see, that's a picture of the natural man. That's all the natural man can do, is be unfruitful for God. In fact, Paul puts it this way in Romans chapter 8. Those that are in the flesh cannot please God. They cannot please God. God did so much for Israel. He looked for them to bring forth fruit, to bring forth grapes. They brought forth wild grapes. And Saul is a picture of that natural man, a man of the flesh. And so we recognize that we all have a healthy dose of flesh within us. We still have the old man. And Paul explains in Galatians chapter 5 that the spirit lusts against the flesh and the flesh against the spirit. These two are contrary the one to the other. So there's a battle going on. And so one of the main purposes of looking at Saul, a man after the flesh, is to see what we can learn from his life that might be helpful to us in a practical way as we deal with the flesh in our own life. And so that's sort of just a general overview of where we hope to go. And I've been given the next couple of Wednesday nights as well, and I'm sure it'll take longer than that. But that's what we're going to be doing, is looking at this man Saul. But we want to set the stage by looking at chapter 1 of Samuel, 1 Samuel. What a great chapter. We're going to try to cover the whole thing. I'm not going to read every verse, but to look at some of the highlights. Especially I'm not going to read verse 1 because I can't pronounce all those names, but let me just summarize it. In verse 1, we learn about a man named Elkanah. And Elkanah was a Levite. He was from Bethlehem. He was from Bethlehem in Judah. He was an Ephrathite, it says. Though he lived in Ramah, he was from Bethlehem, Judah. And we read there in verse 2, and he, Elkanah, had two wives. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So what do we see in that verse? A man with two wives. Well, that's one too many. You know, we see in the Old Testament, we see evidences of polygamy. Is it that funny? We see polygamy in the Old Testament, but that was not God's design. That was not his intent. It was his permissive will, but it wasn't his perfect will. In the words of the Lord Jesus, from the beginning, it was not so. It wasn't God's plan that man would have more than one wife. Well, Elkanah had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And many feel that he probably, we don't know this for a fact, but it's likely that he married Hannah first. And when it was discovered that she couldn't bear children, then he took a second wife. And he did bear sons and daughters through his second wife. So we've got a man who was a Levite who had two wives. And Hannah had no children. And this man, verse 3, went up out of the city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. So this man was a spiritual man, and he went up every year to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Now, we have that title, Lord of Hosts, mentioned twice in chapter 1, and this is the first time you come across it in the Word of God. And it is a title of absolute supremacy and sovereignty, Lord of Hosts. We think of hosts, we think of angelic hosts, we think of the armies of heaven. But many think it even would include the armies of earth as well. So our God is the Lord of hosts. He is absolutely sovereign. He is absolutely supreme. So this is quite a glorifying title of God. So they went up to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Now, Shiloh was where the tabernacle was established after they got into the promised land. The tabernacle, we know, was portable. They would pack it up and they would move from place to place and they would set it up and they would take it down and move to the next place and so on and so forth. But when they got to the promised land, they set it up in Shiloh. I think it was there for 7 years before it ultimately ended up in the place where God had put his name, which was Jerusalem. But it was at Shiloh, I think, for 7 years. So the tabernacle was at Shiloh at this point. And so this is where Elkanah and his two wives went to worship the Lord of hosts, in Shiloh. And Eli, the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Eli was the high priest. One of his two sons would have been the next high priest. Okay? We're going to see more about them as the story unfolds. In verse 4, and when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions. But unto Hannah, he gave a worthy portion or a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. Now, you got a man already that's got two wives. One is barren, one is fruitful. Now, that right there, I mean, never mind the barren and fruitful part. Two wives is enough of a problem. But now he's got one that's born children and one that can't have children. And the one that can't have children, Hannah, it seems, was the true love of his life. And he gave her a double portion. So just try to imagine the animosity between these two women. The one taunted the other because she had children. Okay? Penina taunted Hannah because she had children. Hannah, no doubt, was jealous because of that. And yet, Elkanah gave the double portion to Hannah. So Penina had reason to be jealous of Hannah, and vice versa. It was not a healthy situation, to say the least. And we see that that's exactly what happened. There was a lot of animosity going on. The Lord had shut up her womb. Interesting that we have a number of notable cases in the Word of God where we have women that were initially barren that went on to become quite famous for the sons that they bore. Sarah would be an example. In fact, there's a further similarity here because, you know, you have the animosity between Sarah and Hagar. You know, Hagar had Ishmael. Sarah was barren. So you've got that situation with Sarah. You have the same situation with Rebekah, who was barren. And you have the same situation with Rachel. So here are three prominent women in the Word of God that in the Old Testament that were initially barren, and yet they became quite famous because of the sons that they ultimately ended up having. And this is another example here, as we'll see, with Hannah. And her adversary, verse 6, also provoked her sore, that would be Penina, for to make her fret because the Lord had shut up her womb. That had to be painful. I mean, it was pretty tough for a Jewish girl in those days not to be able to have children. It was a reproach to her. And it had to be a heartbreak. And here's the other wife taunting her because of the fact that she's barren, because the Lord had shut up her womb. Verse 7, and as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Hannah was heartbroken to the point she couldn't even eat. She was being taunted and ostracized by the other wife that had children, and she had none. Verse 8, then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? He might have meant well, but hey, husbands, don't. I mean, if your wife is brokenhearted and grieving, don't go up to her and say, in effect, what he did. What's your problem? You've got me. What more could you want? That's not going to fly, you know? I mean, that's essentially what he said. What are you so upset? You've got me. What more could you possibly want? I'm better than 10 sons, right? You know? That's what he said, essentially. Okay. I think he meant, well, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt anyway. So Hannah rose up, verse 9, after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. Now I want you to notice, here it's called a temple, but it wasn't the temple. The temple had not been built yet. But I think it's referred to as a temple by virtue of the fact that it was now stationary. It was in one place. It was no longer being moved from place to place. So it's called the temple, but it is not, I mean, Solomon's temple had not been built yet, so it's not that temple. It was the tabernacle that was now stationary, and it was referred to as a temple. So don't be confused by that, okay? So Eli, the high priest, it says, sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. So he sort of sat there. That was his little throne, and he sort of oversaw the service of the tabernacle. Okay? That's what we see there in verse 9. Verse 10, and she was in bitterness of soul. She was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. She was a heartbroken woman. She was barren and she was grieving. She was so upset she couldn't even eat. She was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, there's the other instance of that title, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. Hannah, in her brokenheartedness, in her grief, in her anguish of soul, she cries out to God, and she says, if you'll just look upon my affliction and remember me and not forget me, but if you give me a man child. She asked for just one child. Interestingly, by comparison, Rachel in Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1, she cried out to God, give me children, plural, give me children or else I die. Hannah said, Lord, one would be great. Give me a man child. And if you'll do that for me, I'll give him back to you. I'll consecrate him to you. In other words, I will raise him as a Nazarite. I'll take the Nazarite vow. He'll be a Nazarite unto you. I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. That's a reference to the Nazarite vow. They were not to touch a dead carcass, no wine, and no cutting of the hair. An outward sign of an inward separation to God. So she makes this vow. If you'll just do this for me, I'll give him back to you. That really should be the attitude of our hearts, regardless of how fruitful we are. We should take the attitude, Lord, as we're going to see later in the chapter, you give them to me and I want to give them back to you, their own loan. And it came to pass, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, when she spake in her heart, only her lips moved. But her voice was not heard, therefore Eli thought she had been drunk. Eli only saw her lips move, but didn't hear anything. So what did he do? He assumed she was drunk. Now apparently, it was not uncommon for women to come to the tabernacle, to the gate of the tabernacle, in an inebriated state. That was, in fact, we're going to find in chapter 2, that Eli's sons were guilty of having sex with some of those same women that came to the temple gate, probably inebriated. So when he saw Hannah, her mouth moving, but he heard nothing, he assumed that she was drunk. You know, it says she spoke in her heart, and only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. I think of this as we come together each Lord's Day to remember the Lord. And you know, the women are worshiping. They are exercising their God-given right as believer priests, and they're offering up worship and prayers unto God. And the thing is, you know, they're silent, but they're silent only as far as we're concerned. They're not silent as far as God's concerned, and that's all that counts, really. They're not silent as far as God is concerned. God sees their heart and he hears your prayer. That's an important thing to remember. Verse 14, and Eli said unto her, how long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial. For out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Here's a woman, so brokenhearted. Verse 7, she wept and couldn't eat. Verse 10, she was in bitterness of soul. She had a sorrowful spirit. Verse 15, she poured out her soul before the Lord. Out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. She was so gracious in her answer to Eli. You know, there's a pretty important lesson for us here, just in this part of the story, in this part of the narrative, and it's this. Well, a couple of things. Last Wednesday night, we were exhorted as believers, we are to love one another. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another. Our brother spoke to us about that. And you know, when we come to the love chapter in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, I thought about this phrase. It's in verse 5. Speaking of love, it says, doth not behave itself unseemly, speaketh not her own, is not easily provoked. And listen to the last part, the last three words of verse 5 in 1 Corinthians 13. Thinketh no evil. Thinketh no evil. That's exactly what Eli did. He saw her lips move. He heard nothing. He jumped to the conclusion that she had been drinking. And he goes after her and says, put the drink up. You must be drunk. What are you doing drunk? He assumed the worst. Love thinketh no evil. Love looks for the best. Love gives the benefit of the doubt. Love does just exactly the opposite of what Eli did. And that is be critical of her under the assumption that she was drunk. And that's the other thing. It was an assumption. And here's the big lesson, and this is so big. We all need to learn this. It's a simple, and yet I think it's a profound lesson. It's this. Things aren't always as they appear. Things aren't always as they appear. Eli looked at Hannah. He rushed to judgment. He was wrong 100%. And he treated her accordingly. And yet she was amazingly gracious in her response to Eli. Things aren't always as they appear. And a lot of times, and I think it's incumbent upon us, if we take that truth and we couple it with what we just read in 1 Corinthians 13, love thinks no evil, then what you end up with is believers that love one another, that look for the good in the other person rather than looking and making the assumption that it must be the worst case scenario. Love thinketh no evil. Love looks for the positive, not the negative. And a lot of times I think, you know, it's so easy in the context of a local assembly. You know, you might see something and it might appear to you this way. Maybe you don't like the way the elders did this or that or whatever, and you rush to judgment. You know, you think, well, they've made a mistake. The fact of the matter is, many times you don't have all the pertinent facts. You don't know what went into the decision. And it's easy because, again, I keep coming back, things aren't always what they appear to be. And we need to remember that. And we need to incorporate that attitude of loving one another and taking the attitude of giving the person the benefit of the doubt rather than just making the assumption that they're guilty before getting all the facts. So she explains the situation to Eli in verses 15 and 16. And Eli has a little bit of a change of heart. He gives her his blessing in verse 17. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. Notice verse 19. And they rose up in the morning early and worshipped before the Lord and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. They got up early in the morning, and what did they do? It says they worshipped before the Lord. You see, worship was a priority. Now, this was the day that they were headed back home. They probably had a long, hard journey ahead of them. And how easy it would have been to have said and rationalized and say, look, you know, we've got a big trip tomorrow. The last thing we want to do is get caught in 8 o'clock traffic, so we better get up and get on the road. No. They got up early in the morning and they worshiped. Worship was a priority, even if it meant getting up early. They did what it took to make sure that they worshiped the Lord, and I'm sure the Lord honored them for it. So the Lord remembered her. Verse 20, wherefore it came to pass when the time had come about after Hannah had conceived that she bare a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. The name Samuel means asked of God or heard of God. What a great name. From the standpoint that it was essentially every time she would call his name, she was calling to mind the fact that he was a result of her petition before God. He was the answer to her prayer. He was asked of God. She asked and God heard. Heard of God, asked of God. And this was sort of a perpetual memorial to what God had done in her life and his. Now, when you put all this together, I want you to try to imagine, again, how easy it would have been for Hannah to have had the attitude to have just sort of begun to feel sorry for herself, feel pity for herself, and think to herself, you know, poor old me, this just isn't fair. The other wife has all these children, and I'm barren, and God, what are you doing to me, and I don't deserve this, and why me? And, you know, it's easy to start thinking that way. And yet, think about it from this perspective. If Hannah had not been initially barren, and had it not been for the taunting of Peninnah, she probably never would have had Samuel. She never would have been brought to the point in her life where she, in desperation, cried out to God, please give me just one man child, and if you do, I'll raise him a Nazarite, and I'll give him right back to you. And he'll glorify you as a result. She probably never would have come to that point had she not been barren and had she not been taunted by the other wife. And yet how easy it would be to have a pity party about the whole thing. And it's human nature to do that. And yet, regardless of the difficulties that we face in our life, the day will ultimately come, whether it's in this life or the next, that we will look at life's difficulties and trials and troubles, and we will say what we read in the last verse of Mark chapter 7, he hath done all things well. He hath done all things well. Hannah cried out to God, and God did a work in her life. So, I'm going to hurry through these next few verses. I'm going to summarize the next few verses. What they tell us is this, that Elkanah continued to go up every year to offer the yearly sacrifice, but Hannah stayed behind for a few years in order to wean the child, which was usually around age 2 or 3. She was going to wait. She did not accompany him to Shiloh to worship because she was at home taking care of Samuel until the point in time when he got old enough that he was weaned, 2 to 3 years old, and then she went and presented him to the Lord. Verse 24, and when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with 3 bullocks and 1 ephah of flour and a bottle of wine and brought him unto the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. And they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. So she's bringing him to the temple to fulfill her part of the vow that she made to God when she cried out, God, if you'll just give me a man child, I'll give him right back to you. So she brings him, she takes him to turn him over to the Lord, to leave him at the tabernacle with Eli. So they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord. Now she's speaking to Eli. I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also have I lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. I'll tell you what, I am just struck by the graciousness of Hannah. She runs into Eli. 2 or 3 years have elapsed since Eli basically falsely accused her of being drunk. And she says, O my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee praying here unto the Lord. She says, in effect, remember me? Now, here's what it doesn't say. Hey, Eli, remember me? I'm the woman you falsely accused of being drunk. You know, like the women that your sons have sex with at the gate of the temple, the one you falsely accused. And I'm here because God heard my prayer, gave me a man child, and oh, by the way, I'm here to present him to the Lord. He's going to serve the Lord by serving you. That's probably what I would have said. That's not how Hannah handled it. She was so incredibly gracious in what she had to say to the high priest. She was the demonstration of 1 Corinthians 13. She showed love. When he didn't, she did. She could have said so many things, falsely accused, and you were so harsh and so mean. She was so gracious then, and she was so gracious once again, as she points out that God had heard her prayer, answered, and she's there now to present Samuel to the Lord. Therefore also have I lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. What a sobering reminder that our children are just on loan to us. They're just on loan. We've got them for about 18 years. And then we turn them loose. You know, it talks about the quiver full of arrows. Well, the day comes when you finally draw the bow and you release the arrow. You turn them loose. They belong to the Lord. You commit them to the Lord. You raise them for the Lord. And that's all we can do. Their own loan. I like that word, lent. You see, if you get a loan or if somebody, if somebody comes to you for a loan, the bank doesn't give you a loan. You have to pay it back, right? If I come to Dave and I say, Dave, I want you to loan me your skill saw or whatever tool he's got. He's got all the tools. Dave, I want you to loan me your tool. Well, it's a loan. He's not giving it to me to keep. The idea is he's going to get it back. And that's how our children are. When we give them to the Lord, when we commit them to the Lord, their own loan, and anything we loan to the Lord, he repays just like the bank. You pay back your loan. Okay? It's not a gift. He lets me borrow his skill saw. Well, I have to give it back. It's a loan. And anything that we loan to the Lord, guess what? The Lord repays. And he always repays more than he owes. A lot of lessons in that first chapter. So my intention is to continue. I'm going to stop at 1 minute after eight. Make history tonight. And we'll pick up here and again continue to look at the backdrop to the introduction of King Saul next week and the week after. Thank you.